Right, so I want to talk today about, it's 1 hour, right? Oh, really? So I want to talk about shock dynamos and magnetic stability. And the main message, if there is any, is that it might be that simple collisionless shock is not a dynamo. With a question mark, of course, because at this stage we certainly don't know. This is.
What do you mean by a dynamo?
Yeah, we'll talk about it. And. Right, so I will explain everything. So let's start with dynamos. So dynamo, by definition, is the process of magnetic field generation or amplification. But usually when we use the term dynamo, we mean amplification by a large factor, some large power, and in a short time. So for example, the standard terminology would be that if you simply take a uniform magnetic field, put it into a vortex, and let it do these curls, this is not a dynamo. This is just slow amplification of the magnetic field.
What is being specifically wanted to generate net flux?
Not necessarily. But the main emphasis here is that it's done quicker than linearly in time. So you can start with virtually zero seed. It should be, if we are to use form, because dynamo is actually a well, especially as you know, kinematic dynamo is a well-developed theory. There is a classification there, fast dynamos and slow dynamos. We're interested in fast dynamos. For us practical people, fast dynamo means that formally, you do need a seed, but a seed which comes from short noise, then amplified by kinetic instabilities, will suffice. Because
you live with things that say, well, I had, for example, some turbulence around which takes a weak field and increases the field amplitude, but at the price of making it messier and messier.
We shall see whether or not it's at all possible. That's one of the questions we want to consider.
But you don't require it to make a uniform large-scale field.
A uniform large-scale field, of course not. We never see, right. So it will become clearer as we move ahead, right. So, yes? No, it's okay. Interruptions are welcome.
There's a question of whether the cascade is always, if you make a cascade of some sort, is always cascading in a short wavelength.
You would naively think that this is what should happen. But in reality, a fair fraction of magnetic fields tend to propagate to large scales, as we know. The reason is very simple. Magnetic field always wants to unwind. If you do this winding, you put a lot of stress. So it wants naturally to occupy the largest scales it possibly can. Of course, there are lots of caveats here, like, for example, recent not so revolutionary, but still very interesting simulation by my NYU colleagues, Mike Fajan and Wei-Qin Zhang, of relativistic Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, produced, as was expected, magnetic fields on large scales, but large here means 1,000th of the largest, or maybe 1/100th of the largest available scale. But so it depends, there are lots of, on our level, 100 equals 1 at the level of this discussion. So shock dynamo naturally is just a dynamo occurring at a shock. The definition is obvious. And there are, as we have discussed this morning, now there is, I understand, a universal belief that supernova remnant shocks are shock dynamos in this sense, or at least they amplify magnetic fields by a very large factor. But for a theorist, the best example of a shock dynamo, of course, will be the gamma ray burst afterglow. because in an afterglow, what's required, basically the temperature jumps, and I'm ignoring, since 100 equals 1, Lorentz factor is always few, electron to proton ratio, this is more dangerous, but still few. Then for the GRB afterglow stage, the temperature jumps at the shock transition from whatever it was, let's say 10,000 Kelvin, and then it jumps to a mildly relativistic temperature of 1 GeV, which means that magnetic energy should jump by a factor of 10 to 9, or maybe 10 to 6, maybe 10 to 7, because we are told that somewhat weaker fields will do the job. So in this sense, GRB afterglow must be a shock dynamo, and also in terms of length scales, because for this model, for the phenomenological synchrotron model to work, you need to populate almost the entire downstream with the strong magnetic fields. You cannot put them into a few hundred skins. This will not work because you need to populate 10 to 11 skins with this strongly amplified magnetic field. And so, yes?
You don't need such a strong amplification earlier than the
You certainly do for gamma ray burst proper, but in the gamma ray burst proper, you can do it without any fancy new developments, because the current picture is that gamma ray burst proper looks like this. You eject something, well, it will not look like this, but you understand, with Lorentz factor, let's say 100, then you eject something with Lorentz factor, let's say, whatever, 300, you go to the frame, which is the center of mass. In the center of mass frame, you have this guy and this guy moving towards each other with Lorentz factor, whatever it is, 1 point something. Okay, the whole frame now is moving with Lorentz factor 150 or whatever. And now here, this is a perfect situation for hydrodynamo, because this is my next remark here. So I start with obvious remarks, of course, just to stir up. So this then would be a perfect dynamo, because there is here obviously a vertical flow. Even if I treat it hydrodynamically, I have a vertical flow, some instabilities. So I will have, for a light crossing time, a hydrodynamic stirring in the system. But, like I said, this is my next remark. We know that conventional hydrodynamos do work, and the simple recipe is, so long as there is stirring, there is magnetic field generation. So this is how the Earth works. Sun, maybe accretion disks. This we don't know for sure, but very likely. Maybe the galaxy, again, we don't know for sure, but very likely. This thing is, I'm told, totally fixed in the sense that in their computers, they can simply reproduce credible behavior of the Earth magnetic field with reversals and with everything. Unfortunately, theorists are reduced to watching the movies they generate, so there is not much I understand. Simple story didn't come out of those simulations. But at least we understand how it works. So the field dies by the turbulence and is regenerated by the turbulence, hence this 11-year cycle and stuff like that. And so this is how it goes. So the simple recipe, so long as there is stirring, there is magnetic field generation. Now, what's the problem with the shock dynamos? Is there any? One remark before I go to the problems. It would be wonderful if we can totally decipher how the shock dynamos work and whether or not they win over conventional hydrodynamic instabilities, because shocks, of course, are everywhere. In particular, the first stars, someone mentioned today, the first stars certainly come through a shock stage. And or the first, when the galaxy is forming, there is this virialization shock. So if indeed there is such a thing as shock dynamo, we have solved many problems in one go. Like, for example, the first magnetic fields, even if there is something during electroweak phase transitions, we ignore them. The first fields appear simply with the first shocks. And the first light in the universe is not coming from stars. It's coming from the first shocks which appear before the stars form. Of course, this synchrotron light is too weak to see, but anyway. So it would be wonderful if we can understand how shock dynamos work, if they work indeed. So this is our next topic is there is a problem with shock dynamos. The problem is it's not clear there is enough stirring in the system. You see, a set of Taylor is an attractor. You explode a cylinder, later on it becomes a sphere. Why is that? Because set of Taylor is an attractor. Any flow which was initiated as an explosion, no matter how asymmetrical, at a later stage becomes a nice spherical asymmetrical wave. So set of Taylor blessed wave certainly is very, very stable. So it's you don't produce any turbulent hydrodynamic flows just by injecting energy in a hydrodynamic regime. Now, exactly. So then it comes to this again. This is the simulation by Andrew McFagan and now and Goodman, probably also with Wei-Chin Zhang. Is that once you put this in homogeneities, indeed, as the shock moves past them, you generate some vorticity. Maybe it is indeed the truth.
You can get bad vorticity. You can get non-set of. You can get solutions that don't attract the set of Taylor.
If you use fancy density profiles, but for density profiles which are not too sharp functions of radius, the blessed wave is nevertheless stable. So it is very stable.
Mean density doesn't change as a function of radius or angle, then this is true.
But even if it changes,
of course, if you have an explosion in an exponentially stratified atmosphere or something,
if you have an explosion inside a wind, or if you have a fast wind inside,
if the wind is 1/r², that doesn't work, David.
In supernova, eject all the time. They have all sorts of crazy.
Yeah, you just don't listen to what I say. If it is 1/r², that is still stable. So if you have a constant wind atmosphere and you do an explosion in the center of this atmosphere, it attracts to a spherically symmetrical solution. It is still stable. You need to really mess around with the profile to make it unstable. The reason for this stability is pretty obvious. It's just more or less causality. So, yes?
No, I think there are counterexamples to that. I think he's right, actually. I think he's right under a certain set of assumptions.
Yes.
But you can, if you make the explosion extended in time, it doesn't have to conform to the set of Taylor set of assumptions. You have a fast wind inside a slower wind, for example.
But it still is true that the dynamics tend to put all the compression into a single shock, and once that's established asymptotically, it goes into something very much like a set of Taylor solution.
But you are going somewhere, right?
Yeah, what are we saying?
Yes, exactly.
Here we can talk. Exactly.
And then we can criticize what the outcome is.
Yes.
Okay, so set of Taylor is an attractor, period. There is also Blanford-McKee. Now, Blanford-McKee is not an attractor. However, it is neutrally stable. In fact, everybody knows it. That's why they talk about jets, right? So again, by simple causality, Blanford-McKee is not an attractor. So This might play a role. So at the moment, the jet realizes it is not part of a sphere. It is not a sphere. It can go unstable. And in fact, I think there was a suggestions exactly like this by Milos Lavlevich and Ihud, not Barak, but what's his name? Nakar, yes. Now, okay, so you see, it seems that there is no continuous stirring in this problem, in the shock dynamics. So we come now to the main question we want to address. What's going on? Because phenomenologically, of course, we are forced to believe that shocks are dynamos. The question is, what exactly makes them dynamos? So the most revolutionary, I think, and interesting suggestion is that once you go collisionless, you solve these problems somehow. But, and if this was true, this would be quite interesting indeed for reasons which I will discuss a little bit later, why I consider this to be so interesting. But it can also be that we are simply missing something. Unidentified. I understand there are some suggestions, like not even an instability, maybe it is just inhomogeneities, maybe you don't even need an instability, maybe life is all that simple, it's just that you indeed propagate into messy enough environment, maybe the pre-existing magnetic field somehow makes any environment messy enough. And so it goes hydro unstable, generates magnetic fields by the usual mechanism. This doesn't kill the shock totally, but it certainly totally changes the dynamics of the shock, because there is big difference whether or not the fields are indeed shock generated or they are generated by some large scale stirring. So this very likely will change the results as for the particle spectrum and stuff like that. So if indeed this is what's happening, it's very likely changes the way we should read our particle and cell simulations. This doesn't, of course, invalidate them, but the relationship between peak simulations and observations, if indeed this is the true dynamo mechanism, is open for discussion.
The thermal distribution of particles isn't attractive, right? I mean,
no, because in hydrodynamics, you are not talking about distributions of particles. In hydrodynamics, there is no...
You have an intrinsically, if you have a thermal plus now with a non-thermal tail, you have intrinsically something that is out of equilibrium.
Of course.
And that generates then a magnetic field, if you take it on a very abstract level.
Yes, but it generates the fields on very, very small scales. And it is not clear that the fields that we are observed... Of course, if you are to prepare a plasma with a counter streaming particles and let it go, then for a short time period, you will certainly generate strong magnetic fields on length scales over the skin. The question is, what happens to it next? The question is, what is the true input? What is, so certainly, if you prepare this, but if there are hydrodynamic instabilities, which actually do generate large-scale magnetic fields somehow, then the very structure of the shock, what exactly do you call the shock, all have to be, you have to reconsider all those things. That's why, in fact, this would be a theorist's dream, because here the setup is so much simpler and transparent. So in fact, this is what I want to discuss right now. So like I said, this is what I find the most interesting topic here is to what extent these things are indeed occurring in the real world. Of course, it's a very hard question, so I mean, it's much easier to ask than to answer. But let's talk about the problems with this simple collisionless shock mechanism. So what's wrong with simple collisionless shock mechanism? So let's consider this setup. I have a semi-infinite space bounded by a wall. I take a cold uniform plasma and I slam it against this wall at time zero. So at time zero, I give all these particles some velocity towards this thing. There is no pre-existing magnetic field. What will this system do? Let's try to ask. First of all, let's list all the parameters which characterize this setup. These are the Lorentz factor of the incoming plasma, the proton to electron mass ratio, so two dimensionless parameters, and then there are some dimensionful parameters. Density of the incoming plasma, mass of electron, charge of electron, speed of light. Now this, guys, since for me 100 is 1, I will simply ignore for the sake of the argument. So I totally skip questions which interest many people so much, like electron injection. No problem here. There is no difference between electrons and protons. What about these parameters? Now in the astrophysically relevant situation, so if there are these parameters, I can form one-dimensionless, which is no good. But actually, for the shocks we are considering, we are safe in the Vlasov regime, in the collisionless regime. So for particle and cell simulations, this simply means you can divide this by two, multiply this by two. It gives the same simulation, only with better resolution. So the real set of parameters are this. It's the mass density, the charge density, and the speed of light. But now it's very good because we have only three parameters and we have three dimensions. So it means that this problem has been solved right now because since all of these are the only parameters, I can answer any question just by analysis of dimensions. Like for example, right, to give you an example that these are the only parameters, for example, plasma frequency. Okay, so it's only these combinations which enter the answer. Okay.
No, you need more parameters. You have to describe what happens at the wall.
So at the wall, my setup is a simple reflection, of course.
Then you have to have a magnetic field.
This is my setup. The wall here is just to initiate the shock. It sends the shock. Mm-hmm. So the wall here is irrelevant. It carries no parameters in my setup anyway.
It's a pure Gedankovic setup. The wall is a perfectly reflecting boundary. Any particle hits it, just bounces back.
Exactly. And it's only here to send off a shockwave.
But you assume only normal incident, no, I believe.
There is no magnetic field in the initial setup. We are talking amplification by infinity here.
Well, he could.
But it's normal incident.
You could boost parallel to the wall and it wouldn't make any difference. What you're saying, I think, is there is only one problem here.
Yes.
One unique solution.
Right? That's like I said, this is a theorist's dream. Let's see what's this. Of course, there are many elaborate. You can have pre-existing magnet. Let's see what this simple toy can give us. And before we move forward, we need to figure out what happens here. This is the simplest possible formulation for the shock dynamo. Let's see what it will do for us.
The wall infinity?
Yes, semi-infinite space. So everything is so I deliberately avoid any external parameters because then it's easy to answer any question. So like I said, just from dimensional analysis we can answer any question. So one interesting question is this. So this sends off a shock, it moves away. So let's wait for a long time when the shock is far away from this wall. This shock will be surrounded by some turbulence. Let me assume that the turbulence asymptotically at infinite time becomes statistically stationary, meaning that there are, of course, fluctuations, but at a given distance from the shock, the fluctuations reach a certain amplitude. So let me measure b squared averaged as a function of x, x being the distance from the shock. It should be called z, but whatever. So then there is some post-shock. I don't know how it looks. There is some pre-shock. I don't know how it looks either. And there is some width. So this will be the width of the shock transition. So what is the width of the shock transition, if there is indeed an asymptotically well-defined width of the shock transition? Then I know the answer immediately. It can be zero, it can be delta, or it can be infinity. Right? Those are the only dimensionally correct answers. So you are saying there is no shock width.
Not if you have an infinite wall.
Exactly.
So?
Since there is no shock width, you would say it's infinity, right? That would be. So basically, the longer you wait, the wider it becomes. Very good. So let's see what this thing means. So besides, thank you for this comment, this is what we need for phenomenology to work, because these two answers wouldn't account for the GRB afterglow. So we have to select this infinity. All right, we select this infinity, but of course, infinite width of the shock cannot establish immediately. So apparently, there will be some kind of a growth rate for the width of the shock as a function of the shock lifetime.
What was delta?
But of course, you know.
I think I know, but I
don't know. Right. So delta is the only centimeters that I have from here. So delta is C over omega p. And by the way, of course, for example, what's b squared here? B squared here is n m c squared. Any question you can answer by analysis of dimensions, right?
Gamma.
Sorry?
Gamma.
Oh, yeah. Gamma I ignore, like I said. For I'm so crude now. Both of these are one. Okay, so we are forced to select this answer. Now, this answer means that the width of the shock is a function of the lifetime of the shock. So what function of the lifetime of the shock is that? Again, by analysis of dimensions, I know all the answers. Some function of omega p times t, and obviously for t much greater than omega p minus 1, it should be some power law. What is this power law here? By causality, this power law should be less than 1, because if alpha is 1, then this guy simply moves at the speed of light, order of the speed of light, of course. So this thing follows just from causality, but if our model is to be phenomenologically successful for the purpose of the GRB afterglow, I am forced to choose alpha equals 1. All right? Again, for obvious reasons, right? Because if my alpha is less than 1, so it propagates, say, diffusively or whatever, then by the time, let's say, of the optical afterglow, the size of the shock is of order 10 to 18, or optical going to radio, 10 to 18 centimeters, delta is 10 to 6 centimeters. So any power other than 1 will be a phenomenological failure, even though, it propagates much farther than a few skin depth, and the longer you wait, the more skin depth you take, but not enough. You need to take the entire post-shock plasma with this magnetic field. So you see, there are some pretty strong requirements for this simple theoretical toy, if it is to explain, for example, the GRB afterglows. This would then be an obvious suggestion, and I'm pretty sure you people who do the actual work here, particle and cell simulations, they have already thought about it, but maybe I just want to be like a cheerleader and say that it would be very interesting and I think important to measure this exponent, if at all possible.
Doesn't everything depend on the fact that you don't have an infinite
wall? In simulations, you mean?
In nature?
Anything. Exactly. So this, I'm just saying, this is one possibility. I'm saying what I would have done if I had an infinite computer, if I could program it, I would take this wall and I would measure this thing. Because if I measure this thing to be one, then indeed this, you are saying you need to bring in some new parameters. What I'm saying is, before I bring in new parameters, I want to explore this thing to the end.
You can't run this program for an infinite time, even on an infinite computer. So, I mean,
but to establish asymptotic, you don't need. People have established Kolmogorov asymptotic.
You're not doing it for an infinite time. That's the whole point. It's for a finite time.
Yeah. Then you have another parameter that comes in.
Yeah, this is time. T. Yes,
T.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Of course. So this is all you do. The longer you wait, you should discover that your shock becomes wider and wider. Theoretical prejudice tells you that it will become wider and wider in a power law fashion, because just from simple self-similarity, this power law potentially is measurable.
Alpha equal one means ballistic spreading.
At the speed of light, exactly.
Yeah, but then you have sort of interpenetrating. Plasma.
No, because in fact, I would think that this would be, maybe Anatoly can interfere, would be his favorite model, that in fact it is alpha 1, but remember, I'm doing order of magnitude here, so it is obviously one-third or whatever.
Coefficients is okay, but alpha 1 is a little disturbing because it's...
But that's the only thing which can work phenomenologically.
So why was delta excluded?
Where delta is here. Since it is width, it is equal to delta.
There are three solutions. Zero.
Zero, delta.
And a growing one which grows like.
Delta is excluded because it means that this 10 to 18 centimeters shockwave has only 10 to 6 layer occupied by the magnetic field. It will not do enough synchrotron emission from skin depth.
I thought we went from it was purely abstract, but you really want to know the temperature.
I am doing an abstract problem. The gamma ray bursts are here to motivate the questions I'm asking about this abstract problem. So as an abstract problem...
I mean, it's very abstract in the sense that you leave the total magnetic field out to start with, right? You want to get the magnetic field out of nothing.
Of course. And in fact, this is what we do get from particle and cell simulations. Just shot noise, plus there is no flux conservation theorem in kinetics. So from shot noise plus Weibull instability, you get magnetic field. And in fact, from realistic shot noise, I'm not, of course, in numerical simulations, they get from numerical shot noise. But if you just use the actual shot noise, electrons are discrete in nature. So the actual shot noise indeed will be amplified by Weibull in no time. This is B. I'm doing it for B. There can be different widths, and this is another thing which should be sorted out.
There are good reasons, again, going back to high publicity and
right.
Why the shock itself will remain a finite thickness, but it can leave behind it.
In fact, it's very... I think this is what, again, Anatoly's view of what's actually happening will be. So anyway...
But in that case, you cannot rule out delta.
Say again?
In that case, you cannot rule out delta, right?
I cannot what?
Rule out the possibility that W is equal to delta.
Exactly. It would be, to my mind, it's kind of funny that we are told that the density jump occurs in a few delta, but magnetic field can't keep spreading out to infinity. This is a kind of counterintuitive picture, but apparently, if I'm misquoting you, you should interfere. But again, this, I think, is what Anatoly is telling us, that the density transition occurs within... thank you for this remark. It's an interesting point also here, is that if instead I was to plot density, whatever, then indeed we are told it saturates.
It's also an artifact of... Decelerate the upstream flow, you really have to decelerate significantly to have density start to build up. Because, you know, if you're going at gamma of 100, you slow it down to gamma of 50, you're not going to build up density. So if you're looking at the density jump, it really happens within a few skin depths where you go non-subrelativistic.
Right.
So if you try the same trick not for non-relativistic shock, maybe the shock will spread.
Then, of course, it brings up the question, if indeed everything spreads, is there a shock? And may, if it spreads, then it should be hydro, I would say. So anyway, this
experimentalist will answer that one for you by saying that at least for a dynamical time of the system, the overall system we're looking at, shocks do form and they are thin over that kind of time scale.
If it's true, then we are done in the sense that we are not simulating GRB afterglow.
I think the interplanetary medium folks would certainly agree that they're not looking at GRB afterglow.
They certainly
do see shocks which are multiple Marmon radii or skin.
And supernovae are also thin, I'm told, right?
This picture may not apply to magnetized shocks. So let's not put in magnetized shocks into this picture.
Good point.
This is a sort of an extreme parallel shock, if you will.
Right. So this is, I cannot say anything interesting anymore on this one, because everybody can think up many, many tests of this nature just using the dimensional analysis, and it's clear that the requirements for this thing to work as a GRB afterglow are pretty stringent. So now I want to move to some particular model of what happens with the magnetic field in the downstream. This model came up in discussions with Anatoly Spivkovsky. So let's forget about the shocks for the time being. We talk too much about shocks anyway. So let's talk about something else. And then we will return to the shocks as a conclusion. So let's talk about magnetic stability. And I will discuss magnetic stability in magnetohydrodynamics first. So you would think that this is a solved problem. The status of this problem is pretty interesting. It's unsolved. What's the formulation, since it's an unsolved problem? What's the formulation, first of all? The formulation is just this. Let me take a dead star, for example, a neutron star or magnetar, or any non-convective star. So in this star, the fluid is no longer moving. We are not doing any stirring. But this star is still hot and ideally conducting. So let me put some magnetic field into this star and let it go. Where will it go to? Will it totally die out, or will it reach some equilibrium configuration and stay indefinitely in this shape or whatever? To simplify the problem, let's forget the star. In fact, for the star, there was a recent beautiful numerical simulation mostly by Braithwaite and Nordlund, where they actually perform this experiment. They excite some turbulence. So for the first time ever, since I know many people here are interested in pulsars, for the first time ever, we have some rough predictions rather than postulates about the surface magnetic field of a neutron star. So the guy simply puts in some turbulence, let it evolve, and he see what spreads out from the surface of a star. Quite beautiful simulations. But I will simplify this to the following problem. I will ignore gravity, I will ignore stratification, I will ignore compressibility. So I will have an incompressible fluid with some resistivity, with some viscosity, but with zero resistivity. So magnetic field is ideally frozen, but the fluid is a little bit viscous. So I put in some magnetic field, so long as this field is out of equilibrium, that is to say, this field exerts some uncompensated J cross B force, the fluid will be moving. But so long as the fluid moves, it dissipates energy by viscosity. So, say it again. Say again?
Isotropically or?
No, I just put anything. I put some magnetic, I take infinite incompressible viscous fluid, ideally conducting. I put in some magnetic fields, say toroidal. Okay? Just a torus, there is some magnetic field inside. I let it go. Where will the torus go into? Now, this problem where the torus will go into, you see? And initially, of course, because field lines want to become shorter, right? That's what they have, what do you call it, tension. So this thing will try to collapse, right? And so the fluid will move and so on. But so long as the fluid moving, magnetic energy, so what will happen to this torus if you wait long enough? This problem was solved apparently by, I don't remember, either Zeldovich or Sakharov or together. This thing goes into zero in a very funny fashion. You split this guy into these guys, and so you can decrease magnetic energy to zero. If you're interested, we can talk later. But let's take this guy. What will this go into? Now, both of them want to shrink. But they are obstacles to each other. So clearly there are initial configurations of magnetic field which will reach some non-trivial equilibrium. Non-trivial simply means non-zero magnetic field. So indeed, there do exist in a plasma stable magnetic equilibria just by this pure thought argument, because the energy decreases, cannot decrease to zero, you reach some stable equilibrium. At this point, of course, we can already say why we are interested. Maybe this is what shocks are doing. They put some magnetic field energy into a small scales, but large enough to be treated hydrodynamically. And hydrodynamically, the field lives forever. But if I say so, why do I call this problem unsolved? Because of the argument by a Russian mathematician Vladimir Arnold. And his argument goes as follows. So let's assume we reach equilibrium. In equilibrium, J cross B force is compensated by pressure, and you will forgive my signs. So I just take this equilibrium equation, multiply both parts as form a scalar product with B. This guy is perpendicular to B, therefore this is zero, so I obtain this guy. That's amazing, right? That you can actually, from this you can extract some consequences, but actually you can, because you see what it means. Let's draw the surfaces of constant pressure. Gradient of pressure is a vector perpendicular to this surface. So this guy says that magnetic field actually lies on the surface of constant pressure. It means that pressure should form nested, that the surfaces of constant pressure should foliate space into nested tori, and magnetic field should go around each torus. But this is clearly impossible for a generic initial magnetic field, because the generic initial magnetic field has the property that each field line fills volume, not surface. Okay? There are intertwined magnetic field lines, each of them a generic field line, actually fills volume, the entire volume, not a surface. But if you take intertwined field lines, which each of which forms a volume, you certainly cannot comb them into this nice nested tori.
But But you can still quantify this by introducing helicity.
I'm just saying so. At this point, I'm just quoting this work. This work starts, where does it start from, doesn't matter. But the right way to start this work is to say, for any topology, I should have a magnetic equilibrium. But then we come to this surprise, that for a generic topology, I cannot have a magnetic equilibrium. Let's ignore helicity and all this fancy
Taylor state, relaxation, force-free field.
Right. This is not a force-free field because we have gradient of pressure. So the point is that this we simply don't know what is the terminal state for a generic initial magnetic field. You are referring to some particular configurations with axis with axial symmetry or whatever. So in some cases,
just force-free field, not necessarily.
Okay, I can take up the force-free field, no problem. Here, in fact, Arnold does it. So let's do force-free field. Maybe the final configuration is force-free configuration. This is a particular case when P is zero. Now, when P is zero, there are certainly no nested tori, right? Because there are no isosurfaces of constant pressure. You can foliate space any way you like. So maybe that's the answer. But what does it mean? It means that curl B is everywhere parallel to the magnetic field B. All right? Now let's take a divergence of both parts. Divergence of this guy is zero. Divergence of B is zero. Parameter lambda foliates space into nested tori. Magnetic field lines on those tori. I can take one step forward and put this lambda to a constant. But at this point, it's already clear that I'm doing too much violence. The space of solutions of the equations of the equation curl B equals B, the so-called Beltrami flows or whatever, is simply too rare to accommodate all the initial topologies that you can offer to this system. So the status is, we don't know. We simply don't know. If you put some messy magnetic field in a hydroplasma and let it go, where will it relax to? There are some suggestions, though, and
if you can quantify the topological constraints on paper, then you can use Lagrange multiplier.
A good friend of mine, Hessen, who was a student of Arnold, together with Arnold, he's another mathematician, wrote a whole book, Topological Methods in Fluid Mechanics. So Arnold's paper is 1986. The book of Hessen and Arnold, called Topological Methods, blah, 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 is 2000-something, if I remember correctly. They discuss this very problem. In fact, there is a whole chapter devoted to this problem. They state that the problem is still unsolved, and they say it would be interesting to see what exactly this relaxation thing does to the system. So it's hard for me to quote because I don't quite understand what exactly are they saying, but the thing should be that certainly we should be able to move a little bit more forward than just say that some singularities must form or whatever, because there should be something which resolves this contradiction between the statement that the system stop and the statement that the system can only stop at a state which is inaccessible to it. So certainly there will be some obstacles, some topological obstacles to this relaxation, but what exactly those obstacles are remains unknown.
But is the singularity in this problem would naturally result in the connection?
Exactly. So this is the interesting part. This is the interesting part of it. So very likely. So let's fantasize now because we are not mathematicians. Exactly.
In an ideal theory means dissipation.
Very good. So in fact, this is exactly what I was heading to. So it's very likely that as a result of this evolution, you will form some singularities. In fact, my proposition is that you form a volume filling set of singular current layers. It doesn't matter what it means. It's enough that we form singularities. Singularities, especially now, let's go back to kinetics, right? We are doing particle itself. This singularity formally means infinite current density. So there is counterpropagating plus and minus things. So I would think that this problem in kinetics will very quickly resolve all these topological obstacles by going to nothing. So this is very likely, because actually even this simple configuration, you see, here I do foliate my magnetic field lines into tori, and yet when these two guys try to contract, they will form on the intersection over here, they will form a singular current layer. So if in kinetics the singular current layer is unstable enough, these guys will reconnect. You will produce one torus, and one torus by this Sakharov-Zeldovich thing goes to zero. So there is, now, is it possible to solve this problem in kinetics? Probably very difficult, because even in hydrodynamics, to properly resolve the formation of these singular current layers, you need, whatever, 512 cubed, maybe 256 cubed. Now, you need to resolve hydrodynamics into particle and cell, so it's a very demanding procedure. So maybe with our current resolution of kinetics, these structures indeed, for example, a torus, will indeed survive in the post-shock plasma for quite substantial time, even though in reality its lifetime is really zero on the scales of... So if this thing is, say, 10 sigma, 10 delta or whatever, hydrodynamically speaking, its lifetime will be negligibly small. So let me conclude to leave space for discussions and alternative suggestions here. So the conclusion is this, that the conclusion of the first part of the talk is simply that this scaling studies of how our shocks become wider with time, what are the correct length scales of, what are the true length scales of the shocks and stuff like that, even though they are very hard to do, I think they are essential. Like, for example, if you can credibly establish that the growth rate of the shock has the exponent alpha here, which is indeed corresponds to ballistic propagation, this would be a strong indication that maybe it can work even for a GRB afterglow. I think we need to try to do scaling studies of our simulation. So this is number one. Conclusion number two, we should leave our minds open to all these hydro instabilities, even if we don't like them on aesthetic for aesthetic reasons, because this needs to be sorted out. And the final thing is just this literal remark, that this suggestion that maybe shocks generate 10 delta fields and those fields live indefinitely ever after is very shaky. I would not believe it until I see some real proof of it. It should not be so from my point of view.
At least.
Right, so then we should go do the studies, exactly. So if I am asked what to estimate the lifetime for 1,000 delta, I would allow myself to make magnetic field exactly equipartition, and then the lifetime of this problem is known. It's just delta n time. It shrinks at delta n speed. For equipartition field, I mean, of course. If the field is smaller, exactly, so it makes everything longer. That's the difficulty of this problem. Even though it makes it longer and unobservable for a peak simulation, once you scale to 10 to 18, this is not a credible story anymore. So that's why I think all these questions, of course, if you address this question separately, you can do a much, much better resolution simulation. So if you take this thing and put it into a big box without any shocks and just see how long it lives, something like this can be tried or whatever.
Can you explain why hydro instability why
higher instability wouldn't run into the same issue of shrinking loops and
falling
out.
Exactly. So that's why I started with these examples of sun, earth, and whatever. How does the field live in the sun? There is continuous stirring. So conventional picture of a dynamo is this. So long as you stir the system, you generate the magnetic field. The minute you stop stirring, the field goes into this relaxation and reconnection.
Stirring well downstream, 10 to the 9 skin depth downstream from the shock, there is a lot of stirring?
In hydro scenario, you mean? Oh, I don't think so. I don't see what is the hydro scenario in the first place. I don't have a hydro scenario. I'm just saying that, you see, hydro dynamo works, period. This is, we know about it. There are many examples of the hydro dynamo. So if I am just trying to guess what's happening in the system we are considering, hydro scenario is a natural outcome, even if I cannot find the hydro instability. Like, for example, take accretion disks. Some time ago, before Vedanov and Balbus and Holly and Chandrasekhar, suppose we didn't know about MRI and we have this accretion disk thing. Some people would have said, let's go kinetics. Maybe in kinetics, the disks around black holes are unstable. There are people who did that.
Spent a long time saying the solution to this is various kinds of kinetic instability.
See, thank you very much. It's nice to have someone who knows.
Right,
so, but this is a very good illustration, just that this danger is over here. In that case, we simply overlooked this nonlinear magnetohydrodynamic instability, which actually governs the disk. At least this is the way we think about it today. So the fact that I don't have a hydro instability, I'm just trying to be a businessman here. I mean, I don't know what's happening. I'm trying to guess where to put my money. So hydro has an obvious advantage that hydro worked in many cases before. Maybe here we just miss the...
Part of the problem, I mean, you're pointing very accurately one of the issues. Part there are different directions one can go, but part of the problem is for GRB afterglows, it's modeled as fundamentally a one-dimensional flow problem. I mean, you're expanding something, there's a shock, there's an upstream flow, there's a downstream flow. If you want to do magnetic field generation macroscopically, you won't get anywhere living in that universe. So that says, well, maybe one is not, has been insufficiently imaginative as to what is the flow properties of an afterglow. Is it just the same, is it just a relativistic version of a spherical blast wave?
No.
What's been done?
This we know.
It's better. You would like to have something that has some shear flow to it.
But this is what I think.
As far as I'm concerned, that's the point where I stop. I haven't said time.
But this is, I think, what Nakar have tried with Miloslavljevic, right? That they did this shock with using the fact that Blanford-McKee is not an attractor. They did. They took a shock with some. Or maybe you can.
Just because of the fact, the causal region.
It's causally disconnected.
It's causally disconnected, and it decelerates. You have more and more parts becoming connected. So in this sense, if you have some kind of perturbation as you decelerate along the way, so at any given time, you have new perturbation coming into the system.
You have to get away from the idealization of I made an explosion into a uniform medium or even stratified, but spherically stratified medium. Mm-hmm. You need to do something which upsets the vorticity that's in that flow.
The
homogeneities is one thing that's being talked about. Gradients, mm-hmm. all the transverse directions, all can play. They can play this role.
The advantage here is that in this case, at any given time, what is getting into your horizon will give you a steering on the scale of the on the scale of the shock. It's an advantage. It isn't watching because maybe you don't have enough time to steer it.
It's nice, yes, in the sense that you stir exactly at the largest scale which is available to the system at this point. So this is the most efficient dynamo that we know of. If you stir on the largest scale, you quickly reach equipartition or roughly equipartition.
So GRBs, you can imagine doing this with a fair amount of freedom. I mean, you know, you're saying the basic underlying model, underlying system is more complicated than the simplest theoretical realization. When you do things where you actually have observations or experiments that resolve the system,
We do have observations of GIBs, come on.
Yes, you don't resolve the system. You have
sometimes they do, I think, with the radio. It's not direct, but...
A little bit when you wait. But what I'm getting at is that one of the places you're playing with the magnetic field is many times what you're trying to come up with is something that does its dynamo, but isn't, is back to my original question, are you imagining dynamo with sort of infinitely stirred together, all complicated, tangled up, like your picture there? Well, on the other hand, if you're resolved, like supernova remnants have this phenomenon, you get angry resolve observation, so you have systematic polarization of the system. Therefore, you cannot infinitely tangle your field.
Of course, right. But by the dynamo, I mean, of course, the case when most of the field energy is at large scales. Because
right.
This is what observed in numerical experiments on the dynamo.
Right. So
you take a system, you stir it, most of the field energy goes to large scales.
What you really want for dynamo is a little bit the traditional dynamo question. How do I manage to make large-scale flux and often have to make it out of small-scale complexity?
And this is exactly what happens in numerics, because
sure.
You are not because
in
there are the...
I can look at the Earth. The Earth is...
Exactly.
You can measure.
No, but it's a good point. Some people think that dynamo is just this linear amplification. So they would say, to generate galactic field, I need some seed, which I amplify every rotation of the galaxy. This is not at all what's happening. In numerical experiments, you see that you inject Kolmogorov turbulence. At the very end, on the small-scale end of Kolmogorov turbulence, where the turnover time is small, you come in equipartition, the magnetic fields and comes to equipartition, and then counterintuitively, if you wish, it propagates, it climbs up Kolmogorov
so
cascade, that is.
Do inverse cascade, by
the way. Right, it is an inverse cascade, if you wish, if you want to put it this way.
Initial helicity, isn't it?
Is it inverse cascade? Don't you just build up the, just because the larger L is taking longer to turn over, that's it?
No.
No?
It is clear that it is the smaller scale fields which serve as a seed to somewhat larger scale fields. So you first come to equipartition there, and then you gradually move up. So the whole process takes much shorter time if you were to just amplify the pre-existing large-scale fields.
But what's small and what's large-scale?
Oh, in Kolmogorov setup, it's totally clear.
No. You can reach equipartition before you reach dissipation scale in MHD.
Yeah, I don't know what you say. What I'm saying is this.
Well, the point is, when you say small scale...
This is what I mean. There is injection. It's okay, I'm drawing. So there is injection. Fluid energy goes like this.
Yeah.
At time zero, you put some seed field.
Yeah.
Okay? You wait. This is magnetic energy now. It climbs up the Kolmogorov cascade.
But first it climbs down. Because as it's rising, in other words, you have to draw two curves and see what they need.
But they usually get both cascades, depending on helicity and other things. They are not, I think,
with
people doing simulation.
You can do, presumably the simulation is do with zero helicity. Right? You do with zero helicity, you don't see large scale fields.
You don't see large cascades.
But you see growth. Yeah, there's growth.
And
wherever growth reaches equipartition, the turbulence depends on the initial conditions.
Yeah.
But you're left then with a.
But this growth is just
a tank field with no net flux.
Absolute motion. Real.
Look, in perfect MHD, flux is always considered. So if you start with zero net flux, you end up with zero net flux. That's true of the live ones. It's true of everything.
But still some larger scales are produced. It's a big difference, at least in terms of acceleration, if you have.
Net flux doesn't matter.
Yeah,
what matters is that you produce large-scale fields with compensated flux, usually, of course.
I'm not sure. Where I bring, I don't know.